This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at reason.com/podcasts or at Apple, Google, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. And also check out Reason's other podcasts too, The Reason Roundtable, which is a rollicking weekly show about the news of the day, featuring Catherine Mangu Ward, Peter Suderman, Matt Welch, and myself, and also the Soho Forum Debates, an audio version of the monthly debate series that Reason co-sponsors in New York City. On to today's show. Are we going to war with Iran? Or are we pulling out of Iraq altogether in the Middle East after the killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani? Is this latest flare-up a sign that Donald Trump, the president of these United States, is playing three-dimensional chess, or is he following in the failed footsteps of Barack Obama and George W. Bush? To answer these questions and to get a good read on foreign policy from a uniquely libertarian angle, I'm happy to be talking today with Christopher Preble. He's the Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Libertarian Cato Institute. From 1990 to 93, he served as an officer in the U.S. Navy on the USS Ticonderoga, and he also holds a PhD in history from Temple University. He's the co-author most recently of Fuel to the Fire, How Trump Made America's Broken Foreign Policy Even Worse, and How We Can Recover, and Peace, War, and Liberty, Understanding U.S. Foreign Policy. Chris Preble, thanks for talking to Reason today.
Thank you, Nick. Thanks for having me.
You bet. You know, let's start with the headline. How big a deal is the U.S. killing?
Unfortunately, Nick, it's a really big deal in the sense that Qasem Soleimani was one of the highest ranking military officers in the Iranian military, head of the Quds Force, part of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. It would be the equivalent of the Iranians or others killing, I've heard, the combination of the head of U.S. Central Command and the head of the Central Intelligence Agency or something along those lines. This is a person who was both an operator and a military leader. He was and one of the key differences between him, for example, and al-Baghdadi, mm-hmm. who was killed earlier this year in Syria, or even going back to bin Laden, is that those individuals were non-state actors. They were explicitly terrorist group leaders, not members of a sovereign state as Iran is. And so by taking action to kill Qasem Soleimani in Iraq, he was visiting Iraq, he was near the Baghdad airport, he was also killed with an Iraqi general, it was one of the heads of one of the militias inside of Iraq, but an Iraqi national. And so mm-hmm. this was a really big deal, unfortunately.
So, yeah. I mean, is the main difference, is it legalistic, you know, that he's a state actor rather than a terrorist? And I'm using air quotes, I guess, in all of these phrases. But is it mostly legalistic that this becomes an act of war that the UN or some other international body would recognize as such? Or is it more moral in that we treat, you know, kind of generals, even of states that we are, if not quite at open war with, you know, hostile to,
right,
differently than we do mere terrorists?
Well, I think there's a legal aspect of this in terms of the, even U.S. domestic law, which prohibits the assassination of foreign government officials. So there's certainly mm-hmm. an element there. But I've frankly, Nick, approached this more from a practical perspective. We could get into the moral questions, we can get into the legal okay. questions, but in terms of from a moral perspective, does this advance American safety and security? Does it make Americans freer and more prosperous? And I think on all those scores, the answer is categorically no.
Okay, let's run through a couple of those real quick. I mean, is when you say it doesn't make us more safe or you know, doesn't make us more safe or less safe, from a pure kind of perspective that's dealing with reprisal, does this make it open season on Americans outside of the Middle East in a way that we should be very worried, or Americans in the Middle East? What are the ways that you kind of tout up how this makes us more safe or less safe? Or is this mostly going to be, and I've read some stories today that talked about how the Iranian government said, you know, we are going to come after American government officials,
right,
of a similar level, and we're going to take them out, and we're going to do it openly. So how should we think about this from in terms of pure reprisals?
Sure. So what I've heard so far is the Iranian officials saying that they will focus attacks on U.S. military personnel and U.S. government personnel, not civilians in a civilian capacity. So things mm-hmm. like tourists and the like. And I do think that's an important distinction. But the Iranian government, while Iran's military is, of course, a shadow of what the United States or even other states in the region have in terms mm-hmm. of conventional military, they do have a pretty extensive network of proxies and security partners and the like. And so that network provides them with the ability to project power, and they've projected power through that network, certainly within the Persian Gulf region and the greater Middle East. And at times, Iranian-affiliated groups have demonstrated an ability to carry out, indeed, terrorist attacks worldwide. So I don't think we could rule out any possible reprisal, although so far the Iranian government has said that they will focus their reprisals on U.S. military and government personnel in the region.
Is there any reason to worry about, Iranian agents in the United States, or do you think this is mostly going to take place somewhere in the Middle East?
Well, I think there has been worry about so-called sleeper cells going back for many years, even going back to 9/11. Of course, even though the Al-Qaeda terrorists were not affiliated with Iran, it's an important distinction. Right. I think that the threats that people have raised to the U.S. homeland would be through cyber attacks. The United States, of course, executed several now fairly famous cyber attacks against the Iranian nuclear program back in the late aughts. And since then, the Iranians have demonstrated certainly not a comparable level of capability, but the willingness and the ability to carry out some measure of cyber attacks against, and that would apply to networks here in the United States. So I think that's a more pressing concern, perhaps, than conventional reprisals here in the United States.
You know, is it possible that this kind of strike, which is pretty bold, and it's something that both by various press reports, both George W. Bush and Barack Obama contemplated taking out Soleimani. They did not, or somebody like him. But is it possible that this is the type of action that makes Iran say, holy cow, this guy Trump is a madman, and we are going to step down, or that they're going to change their kind of actions within the Middle East?
Well, that's certainly what Secretary Pompeo, Mike Pompeo, and what mm-hmm. President Trump himself seem to believe. That's sort of implied in their statements regarding how they expect Iran not to retaliate and to be deterred from retaliating further by threats. For example, the president threatened to bomb 52 Iranian cultural sites. Right. Or Secretary Pompeo, this is consistent, you could argue, with the ratcheting up of what the Trump administration calls the maximum pressure campaign. This is the broad-based economic sanctions that the Trump administration has put on the Iranian people going back to 2018. But I think that what concerns me is that precisely that maximum pressure campaign has demonstrated, it seems to me fairly conclusively, that while these economic sanctions have put real pressure and pain on the Iranian people, we know credible evidence of a number of Iranians dying premature deaths from lack of access to medicine, for example, and things like that. It has not resulted in a change in Iranian behavior. It has not brought the Iranian government to return to the negotiating table to comply with the long list of demands that the Trump administration, through Secretary Pompeo, has placed on the Iranian government, a list of 12 demands, things like that. So we have already before us, going back really to the start of the Trump administration, evidence of Iranian resistance to mm-hmm. ever-increasing levels of American pressure, not capitulation. So if the Trump administration's position is that this next level, this next increment of pain, even if it's, as you say, seems to be the work of a madman, I don't think we have reason to believe that this time around the Iranian response will be to roll over and take it.
And on some level, I mean, we don't know about this particular incident because it's literally only been a couple of days, but how it will play out. But it also seems that Iran has been gaining strength within Iraq before this took place, and you know, right now, the Iraqi government, which we helped put into power, or you know, we created a pretext in which the current Iraqi government was able, you know, the current Iraqi state was able to have elections, et cetera. They're telling us to get the hell out. So, I mean, in the near term, it seems like in terms of Iraq, as well as Syria and whatnot, things are going kind of in Iran's direction. Is that accurate?
I do think so, but I would note that was not the case as recently as in December of just last month. Mm-hmm. There was rising anger and animosity at foreign influence inside of Iraq, not primarily against the United States, but against Iranian influence inside of Iraq. And so what we've actually seen just within the last week is a lot of that anger and resentment now redirected at the United States. Now, don't get me wrong. There was a lot of resentment and anger, as you would imagine, when there is a foreign troop presence in your territory, in your country, that engenders a lot of resistance. I think most Americans would object, for example, if the Chinese were occupying parts of Texas. And so it's not so surprising that Iraqis were upset and have been for some time about the long-term presence of American troops in their country. But it was Iranian political influence, which as you note, has been quite strong in Iraq ever since Saddam Hussein was overthrown. But there was even some resistance to that inside of Iraq. And now instead, that has been sort of turned around. Again, the fact that the United States carried out this attack on sovereign Iraqi territory has really pushed things in the other direction. And yes, it has, I think, at least for the time being inside of Iraq, tipped the balance towards Iran. I'll also say inside of Iran, mm-hmm. there was some rising resentment and anger towards the government. But that what we've seen instead is a massive rally around the flag effect. Because of the killing of this General Soleimani, who was a exceptionally revered figure inside of Iran. And so it has had the effect, if anyone expected this would strengthen the hand of moderate or relatively pro-Western forces inside of Iran, I think it's had exactly the opposite effect.
Before we go to talk more fully about Donald Trump's foreign policy, and particularly how it relates to Barack Obama's and Donald Trump's, or rather George Bush's, let's talk a little bit about, you know, kind of the legalisms that are supposed to constrain the executive branch when it's committing acts of war. Mike Pompeo has said that, you know, we did this in order, the U.S. government did this in order to stop an imminent attack. And so we were justified. The president didn't need to go, you know, get a declaration of war or anything like that. How much credence should we put into that? I mean, and there's a long history of, defense of war that, you know, where Bush did this in Iraq, he did it in certainly, you know, Obama did it in Libya and elsewhere, you know, that we have to act proactively in order to stop some kind of horrible event that's about to happen.
Right.
Should we be buying that?
No, I don't think we should. And because the notion of imminent danger has been so sort of expanded and misshapen that it really sort of, you know, requires us to sort of revisit what the definition actually is, the dictionary definition. So if mm-hmm. we are to believe that Qasem Soleimani was engaged in the planning of an imminent attack, he was near the Baghdad airport. He had just flown into Baghdad. And so are we to believe that he himself was directly responsible or likely to be directly responsible for an imminent attack and therefore taking him off the, you know, killing him and removing him from the battlefield, so to speak, prevented that attack? No, that's not how it operates. In the same way that the United States engages in covert operations around the world from time to time, the killing of the CIA director would not stop all subsequent U.S. Covert operations, for example. So the notion of taking out the head of an organization is going to have operational effects, especially immediate operational effects in the case of an imminent attack is quite dubious. Now, in fairness, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration also expanded and stretched the definition of imminence to include actively planning attacks. And so that we saw that even in the case, for example, of the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American mm-hmm. citizen, claiming that he was engaged in the planning of imminent attacks. Subsequent investigations into that demonstrated that was not the case, at least what we know in the public record. Now, it's also true that the Trump administration, as we speak tomorrow, the Trump administration is supposed to come forward and present publicly evidence that they've so far only shared in private with a handful of members of Congress. But so far, the response, even among members of Congress who have been presented with this evidence, seems they're quite dubious about the claims of imminent danger. So, and again, I don't think, especially in light of what occurred in the run-up to the war in Iraq, I don't think it's unreasonable for Americans to treat skeptically claims of imminent danger posed by a foreign government. And that's exactly.
And I guess we're also coming, I mean, it's just a few weeks ago that we had this massive, kind of revelation or of documents about Afghanistan and about the ways in which the government, within the Department of Defense and within other aspects of the government, people, we were being told publicly things that nobody actually involved in prosecuting the war thought was legitimate. This is one of those moments, isn't it, where, the credibility gap, I guess it was called during Vietnam, Lyndon Johnson had lost all kind of credence with the public, and it was called the credibility gap.
Right.
We are in a massive and persistent credibility gap, and this makes it all the much more difficult to trust anything that we're hearing.
That's right. So there is a pattern of a deception going back not merely to the Iraq War, but as you point out, the Washington Post released these documents, lessons learned into the Afghan War. We now know that that privately military leaders inside of Afghanistan, or those involved in the planning of the operations inside of Afghanistan, knew that the operations were not going well, but publicly they claimed that they were, or that progress was being made. More generally, of course, we have the problem with the President of the United States, Donald Trump, who, shall we say, struggles a bit with the truth. And on top of a pattern of sort of misdirection and deceit on the part of American officials, I think you have to take into account, in addition to that, the president's own credibility problems. And it's not so surprising that a number of Americans are not convinced by the claims of the Trump administration that this was necessary to prevent an imminent attack against American personnel and American interests.
Is it meaningful and is it a good thing that Trump, though, has insisted, since before he became president, when he was running for president, that he's not interested in regime change, and that unlike people like Barack Obama or George W. Bush, he's articulated that or enunciated that just in the past couple of days as well. Is it good that he doesn't seem to be at all interested in regime change?
I would say that it would be good if he also appointed people to his administration who shared that belief, but both John Bolton, who is now gone, but was, of course, National Security Advisor for a long period of time, and Mike Pompeo have been quite explicit about their intention to see the Iranian government replaced by a different government. Now, Pompeo's official line is that they're not seeking regime change, they're seeking behavior change. But again, if you look at the 12 demands that he has placed before the Iranian government, any fair reading of that would interpret that to be a complete capitulation and overthrow of the system of government inside of Tehran. Mm-hmm. And even, of course, John Bolton's longstanding affiliation with a number of Iranian expatriate groups that are explicitly dedicated to the overthrow of the Iranian government. So it's one thing for President Trump to say that, but he has populated his administration with people who are not nearly as skeptical of the benefits of forcible regime change, on the contrary, have actually been among the most outspoken advocates of regime change by force going back several decades.
Yeah, so let's talk about Trump and his foreign policy in kind of context of Obama and George W. Bush. You co-authored a book recently with a couple of other people from Cato called Fuel to the Fire, How Trump Made America's Broken Foreign Policy Even Worse. And how we can recover, which is good to hear, although it's a parenthetical, so it worries me a little bit. But is Trump actually worse than Obama and Bush, or is he simply the most recent president and hence, the one who has broken, who's made things even worse? I mean, can you talk about what is he bringing to the table? Because he says he's not for regime change, but then, John Bolton, shows up and other people who are kind of holdovers or leftovers.
Right.
What is the essence of Trump's foreign policy, and how has he made, just a disaster? Just for brevity's sake, we keep it to the 21st century. We've just been in a complete quagmire
yeah.
since at least 9/11, if not before.
Yeah. So So I think that the one thing that differentiated Donald Trump first from his fellow Republicans running for president in 2016 and then from Hillary Clinton in the general election was his willingness to criticize the conduct of U.S. foreign policy and to conduct and conduct both by a Republican president and by a Democratic president. So that his willingness to sort of call out the failures of U.S. foreign policy over the last two decades was welcomed, I think, by a lot of Americans who just sort of
It was exciting. I mean, there was that moment at one of the Republican candidate debates where he looked Jeb Bush in the eye and, you know, said that your brother lied us into the Iraq war.
That's right.
God, that was, I mean, like only the only person who dared say things like that before was, you know, Ron Paul, right. And he was considered a wackadoo.
Right. So that definitely separated him from other Republicans and then allowed him to draw a distinction with Hillary Clinton. But he also said, even as a candidate, that he expected to, that he planned to significantly increase military spending, which he has done. Mm-hmm. And so if he was really committed to stopping the forever wars or drawing down the overseas U.S. military presence, it's sort of curious that he would also significantly increase military spending, which just those two things don't seem to go together. And I do think there's a broader problem with sort of reading into some of his utterances over the course of the campaign and identifying a common thread of non-intervention or skepticism of the use of force. On the contrary, we have to remember he also talked fairly openly about carrying out attacks on a much broader scale, being much less concerned about civilian casualties or collateral damage and things like that. As again, he said this as a candidate. So I think
he was going to make the sand glow green or something, wasn't he, in the Middle East?
By any stretch, this was not a dove. This was not a person that had great skepticism about the utility of force. What he mostly seemed to betray is a skepticism about how others had used force and he was going to do it better. So I really don't think we should read into that great non-interventionist instincts or a skepticism of the use of force. My colleague, my co-author, John Glazer, and Trevor Thrall is the other co-author. We, John, mostly sort of went through the process and identified four frames of Trump's approach to foreign policy. We have to remember, this is a guy who did not have a well-articulated or even well-understood sort of approach to U.S. foreign policy. It's mostly instinctual. It's mostly reactive and sort of all over the place. But there are elements that can be discerned. They include things like an obsession over respect for American prestige, tendency to sort of concentrate power and influence in the executive branch itself and sort of authoritarian instincts. And this manifests itself in sort of, you know, again, we've seen it play out, criticizing the media as the enemy of the people and expecting executive branch officials to serve him personally, not the Constitution or the government, things like that. Those impulses are not at all consistent with peaceful global engagement or even, non-interference and non-intervention. It, in fact, makes it easier for him as president to carry out an attack like he did against Qasem Soleimani last week. So as we understand now, based on the reporting that's just been released over the last couple of days, this option was presented to him about a week before the action was taken out. And it was sort of a list of options that he could take as president. And there you have it. We have put into our system of government the ability of the President of the United States all by himself to issue an order that the military feels compelled to carry out with no oversight or input on the part of the Congress. And that is absolutely not what the founders intended. And I think now, belatedly, Americans and some in Congress are starting to wonder whether that's such a great idea after all.
Yeah. Can we talk about like where some of the blame goes to, the military? And the New York Times reported this, I think, first or like to the greatest audience anyway, that, you know, the military leaders were saying, oh, you know, we just put the Soleimani takeout option on the list just to pad things out. We didn't expect him to do it. And it's like, you know, isn't it a kind of weird discussion that we're having where it's like, oh, you know, are we supposed to feel bad for the military because they put this on a list of options and then the president, you know, who they, you know, they obviously know how he operates and he's like, oh yeah, let's go with that one. I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, you know, when you say Trump is worse than Obama or Bush? I guess there are two questions that I want to like burrow in on a little bit. First is, exactly how is he worse than somebody like Obama, who, you know, tripled the troop strength in Afghanistan, and he ran as a kind of vague anti-war candidate, tripled troop strengths in Afghanistan, did a bunch of other terrible things, and also lied through his teeth about domestic surveillance and whatnot. George W. Bush, who of course campaigned that he was going to have a humble foreign policy and eschew nation building and region building, and, you know, lost that memo somewhere right after 9/11. You know, is Trump actually worse? And then the other question is, like, how do we deal with this military-industrial complex that, you know, Eisenhower most famously kind of denoted and warned us against?
Right. So
that is there always. But, you know, so tell us how Trump is uniquely worse than Obama and Bush.
Sure. I think that what concerns me most about President Trump's approach to the office of the presidency and his approach to sort of governing as a concept is it's all about him. This is extreme narcissism. It's all about his prestige, his honor, the respect for him, and sort of equating respect for the United States with respect for him. It's a demand for loyalty on the part of executive branch officials and others in government. Again, not just in the executive branch. He's expected right. that same kind of loyalty among Republicans in Congress, most of whom have followed him. And so there's this sort of personalization of the office, and you sort of understand where it comes from. He was put in charge of his family business, and all of the decisions are revolved around him and that office. And he came into the White House, into the Oval Office, believing that the U.S. government behaves the same way. Of course, it doesn't, and yet he has consistently behaved as though everyone around him and everyone in government is supposed to serve his interests. And I think we saw that play out even in the way that the Ukraine scandal has played out. This notion that he would ask the president of Ukraine to do him a favor and dig up dirt on his political opponent, and the reaction, it seems it surprised him a little bit. It's shocking to him that that presidents don't routinely shake down others that they have influence over for their own personal benefit. And I think that's something to me personally that is deeply troubling, because I think that's really very little limiting. Again, we can no longer count. I think it's fairly obvious. We cannot count on Congress to check those impulses, in part because the Republican Party has become so completely subservient to Donald Trump. Donald Trump has, in fact, taken right. over the GOP. And so that's my concern, why I see him as a uniquely yeah. dangerous person. The other question, so, and part of what motivated us to write this book is I didn't want, John and Trevor and I did not want the discussion to be exclusively focused on Donald Trump. And it's not so surprising. He's an incredibly flamboyant figure. He just sort of sucks the life, sucks all the attention to himself. But the reality is that U.S. foreign policy was badly broken even before he came into office. He almost inadvertently had a point when he said that U.S. foreign policy wasn't serving the interests of the American people and American national security. And the problem I see is by focusing so much attention on him that the critics of Donald Trump and the critics of his foreign policy, the danger is that they say, well, we're just going to go back to the way it was before and everything will be great. And that's the point of the subtitle of our book. The U.S. foreign policy was broken. He made it worse. We can't simply return to the way it was before, because the trends in international politics cannot simply be undone. Those trends will exist even whenever Donald Trump leaves office, whether it's in 2021 or 2025 or, you know, pick your date.
Yeah.
Those trends.
Oh, so you're assuming that he'll leave at the end of his second term. Right. I agree with you about that. And in a weird way, it's almost, you know, you obviously you have to deal with Donald Trump because he is the commander in chief and he's calling the shots right now. But it seems almost as if the deep state or the military industrial complex, whatever, the defense establishment benefits from people talking about Donald Trump and taking sides on Donald Trump, because then we're staying kind of on the superficial level and we're not looking at the longer term logic or bias of the way things are. Is Trump do you think, is he worse at foreign policy than Hillary Clinton would have been? And is there a Democrat or a Republican challenger to Donald Trump who you think basically gets foreign policy right?
I think that Hillary Clinton had a fairly long history of support for military intervention, and it's hard to believe that she would have been more reluctant to use force than Donald Trump would have been. On the other hand, I do think she might have been more committed to certain international institutions and norms than he has shown. So I think that's fairly mixed bag. As far as looking ahead, I think that the Democratic candidates at varying levels have recognized that there is this deep skepticism among the American people about the utility of force. And of course, Bernie Sanders probably most emphatically and most consistently. But, you know, even someone like, let's talk about Joe Biden for a minute, because, of course, Joe Biden voted for the Iraq resolution, as did famously at the time John Kerry and Hillary Clinton. And so there was a tendency to sort of lump him together with all of the other Democrats who, in retrospect, were foolish to have listened to the Bush administration's arguments on behalf of the war in Iraq. And yet, as vice president, Joe Biden was one of the more consistent voices of restraint and skepticism of the use of force within an Obama administration that included people like Bob Gates and Hillary Clinton, who were much more hawkish. So I think there's evidence to suggest that Joe Biden, for example, has learned something from the use of force and maybe less likely to support that than he may have been in 2002 and 2003. And so it seems to me that those are the two poles of the Democratic field. And in that respect, if we have within among all the Democrats a skepticism of the utility of force, a reluctance to use force, and precisely, you know, would any of the Democrats, here's a way to phrase this, would any of the Democrats currently running, if presented with an option to carry out a strike against a leading Iranian military official inside of Baghdad, would they have given the order to carry out that strike? I think I can say with some confidence, none of them would say that. I would support that. I say,
but is that enough? Because it's also how many of them, you know, how many of them said don't go to Libya? How many of them, you know, Obama is the reason we're in Syria, right? He ad-libbed, a red line declaration, and you know, Hillary Clinton to this day is still talking about what a triumph, the brilliant success of smart power in Libya and whatnot.
Right. So I think that we're glad that Hillary Clinton is from the scene and is not going to be the next president of the United States. So I'm happy about that. And I think that she's one of those who has not sort of learned the right lessons from our experience of the last 20 years. But candidly, most Americans have learned those lessons. And the class of people who run for high office are drawn from the pool of most Americans. I mean, let's think about this, Nick. At the time of the war in Iraq, at the time that the bomb started falling in March of 2003, over 75% of Americans supported that intervention. And now a roughly equal number, about 70%, now think the war was a mistake. That suggests that American people, the average human being, man, woman, you know, who's been sort of paying attention over the last 20 years, realizes that the use of force in that fashion does not advance American interest, does not advance American prosperity. And so in that sense, I think there is a wisdom that is reflected in the class of people who are running for office. And President Trump does not reflect that because, again, so much of the office, so much of what motivates him in office is his own personal prestige and sort of elevating his status. And so if he thinks that he can elevate his status by carrying out a military operation as he just did, then he's not going to be constrained by the same lessons learned as the rest of us.
How worried are you? I mean, I think the wisdom of the American people, and it might be the fickleness or the gullibility or however you want to define it, but, you know, there has been this massive shift. People think that Iraq certainly, and even Afghanistan, was a mistake, or that, you know, we messed up, that we shouldn't have done things the way that we did things. That's all well and good. We still have Congress, which is, you know, seems incapable, either as a full unit or as the House and or the Senate, to really lay down the law and say to presidents, whether it's George Bush, whether it's Barack Obama, whether it's Donald Trump, no, you know, if you're going to commit to war, declare war, you have to go through us. We're going to restrain you. They never seem to get that message. And it does seem as if you know, there was a strong anti-war movement among kind of moderate or liberal centrist Democrats and certainly the progressive left that went completely missing the moment that Barack Obama took office and was starting to, you know, wield the levers of power. Is this just, of course, everybody is anti-war until they get into office, and then suddenly they're like, oh, you know what, we need a little bit of flexibility, autonomy, and the ability to, you know, just crush whoever we want at any given moment?
Well, I certainly hope that's not the case. And I think that that I would go back to Barack Obama, who, of course, talked about the foolishness of the war, went on was on record in thinking the Iraq war was a mistake. And I think, again, that helped him to secure the nomination and win the presidency in 2008. He bumped up against what is subsequently known as the blob of the foreign policy establishment, this instinct to use force to intervene in other countries, other sovereign countries' internal affairs. He resisted that to a certain extent. And I think we haven't talked about this much, but I do think that one of the signature achievements of the Trump, of the Obama administration, and one that President Trump was determined from day one to undo, was the diplomatic achievement of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear deal. Barack Obama privileged diplomacy over the use of force. He privileged negotiations and a willingness to accept less than our maximalist demands in exchange for what was, by any reasonable estimate, a very good agreement for securing and preventing Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. That was the nature of that deal. He did so, and again, he in return for that, he made concessions. Now, that was the criticism that was leveled against him, and I think you could argue that's one of the great challenges for diplomacy generally is that diplomacy entails making compromise and making concessions on both sides. If you don't believe that those sorts of concessions are ever warranted, then you don't believe in diplomacy. You believe in the use of force, and you believe in threats and punishment and coercion and things like that, and the other guy rolling over and taking it. Look at, for example, as I've talked about, Mike Pompeo's 12 demands on Tehran. So, you know, if we want to focus on Barack Obama and the mistake he made in intervening in Libya and overthrowing Muammar Gaddafi, and Libya is now a basket case, if we want to criticize him for his intervention in the Syrian civil war, which he did, which I think was a mistake, if we want to criticize him for dramatically expanding the war in Afghanistan, which he did, that's all well and good. But I also think there was an impulse to try to use diplomacy in a way that we just don't see in the Trump administration. What we see in the Trump administration is a willingness to use force or threats of violence. And again, we have to recognize that sanctions are a form of violence as well. They're causing, as I pointed out, enormous suffering on the Iranian people. And so that does not, to me, suggest a sort of a comfort or even an inclination to engage in diplomacy as a matter of U.S. foreign policy.
You have been busy over the last year, which makes a lot of sense, writing books. We talked about the book you co-authored with two fellow Cato scholars, Fuel to the Fire. You also published Peace, War, and Liberty, Understanding U.S. Foreign Policy. This is your own kind of take on U.S. foreign policy. And in that, you essentially argued that we should take, or that, the people creating American foreign policy should take to heart Friedrich Hayek's idea of the fatal conceit,
right,
and apply it to foreign policy. And the fatal conceit is, and I'm quoting from your book, the presumption that man is able to shape the world around him according to his wishes without regard to the limits of his knowledge. You note that Hayek, mostly talking domestically, warned of the unintended consequences that result from even the best intentioned of human designs. Could you do a thumbnail sketch at this, you know, point? I was going to say at this late date in human history. I feel, you know, we've been in the, I watched The Watchmen on HBO.
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, we're always like at, you know, quarter to midnight, if not closer. But what is the capsule principle of an American foreign policy that you think would work in the 21st century, where we have less control and less hegemony than we used to, or we at least acknowledge that, which is a good thing.
Sure.
But that, you know, that is up to the task of, you know, protecting American interests and American freedom in the 21st century.
Sure. I mean, I think the first half of the book, Nick, is really a quick survey of U.S. history, the U.S. foreign policy, fairly episodic. And then the second half talks about sort of principles that derive from that. And again, I draw on Hayek, as you say, it is libertarian in its orientation. It's a publication of libertarianism.org, which is sort of mm-hmm. subsidiary of Cato. And I did very explicitly sort of try to make this argument on behalf of libertarians, but thinking that I'm speaking to people who don't think of themselves as libertarians. And the point is this: the United States after the end of the Second World War was extraordinarily powerful, as powerful as any country in human history at that time and since. And it was not so unreasonable for the United States to believe that we could shape the world according to our wishes, but that does fall victim to the fatal conceit, and so mm-hmm. that we see from our experience that even well-intentioned wars end badly, and then there have been a few wars or interventions that haven't been all that well-intentioned, and so what else do we have to draw on? We can draw on the experience of U.S. foreign policy at the founding, and those men and women, mostly men, of course, at the time, really saw the United States as an example for the rest of the world. If we created a society that privileged human liberty, that allowed people to enjoy the fruits of their labor, to raise a family, to build a life, if we created a society that actually worked, that actually functioned, then other countries would like to be like us. They would want to emulate us, and that would advance human liberty. We do not need to impose it on others. We do not need to do this at the barrel of a gun or under the threat of you know, invasion or whatever. And I think it actually worked remarkably well for most of human history, for most of American history. This process, this example actually worked. And I think it could work again. However, we at this moment are not presenting to the rest of the world a very good model for emulation. We have some problems right here at home. We are our political system is frankly dysfunctional. The level of dissension and division within this country really makes it harder for us to send this message that liberal democracy, as we practice it here in the United States, is one that will work for others. And so I really think, in some respects, we need to focus on what it is that makes us strong and secure before we go about around the rest of the world telling them how to live their lives and how to organize their politics. And it's almost, I mean, it's striking to me that I have to make that argument because it would seem so obvious at this moment in time when the United States Congress cannot, you know, pass most legislation at all, or, you know, it's just shocking how bad the system is. And yet we still think that we are going to dictate to other countries how they should conduct their domestic affairs. Frankly, it's fairly absurd. So my message above all else in this book is that we need to have more confidence in our system. We need to have more faith in what it is that makes our system effective and invest in it. And then we need to believe that others around the world want similar things and are willing to at least try to do it as we did it. And that process actually, as I said, it did work fairly well for a good part of American history, and then we departed a little bit from it during the Cold War and after.
Was there you know, in the post World War II era, has there been a good war that we've prosecuted, or, you know, what would a successful intervention look like? Because you are not a pacifist, and you are, I guess I would call you a non-interventionist, but you're not an anti-interventionist. Your predilection is that you're slow to anger, right?
Yeah, I think that I am.
you're like Billy Jack.
That I'm slow to anger. No, I think that's right. One of the problems with the term non-interventionist is it shouldn't imply never intervening. It shouldn't imply that the use of force is never appropriate. But the United States is extraordinarily fortunate in our geostrategic position, our economic position. The simple truth is the United States does not have to use force in order to be safe and secure. So the bar should be set very, very high for when the United States should use force. And when it does use force, it should have a very, very clear object in mind. I use a set of criteria. I call them new rules. They're not all that new. They're not all that original. Frankly, they pertain to things like there should be a clear national security interest at stake. There should be strong public support for the mission. There should be a sense that the mission is achievable and at a reasonable cost, and that the rest of the world would see the use of force as genuinely a last resort. Because here's one of the things about U.S. power, because we're so powerful and because the international system does not have a lot of constraints on our power, we have to restrain ourselves. If we don't, then you really can see multiple opportunities for the United States to use force. If you use those criteria, I think the intervention in Afghanistan after 9/11 would meet all of those criteria. And I would hasten to add the initial intervention in Afghanistan, right, because what has happened in that war after we successfully deposed, drove out the Taliban government that had supported al-Qaeda, and we disrupted the al-Qaeda training camps in Afghanistan, we then embarked on a much broader mission to try to create a functioning nation state inside of Afghanistan according to our model, which was not realistic or reasonable at a reasonable cost. And lo and behold, we're still paying that price 18 years later. So I do think the Afghan war, as it was initially undertaken in late September, early October of 2001, would meet those criteria of a justified war. No war is a good war. No war, the war, I think we have to look on war and the use of force as a failing, a failure to resolve differences by peaceful means. But that doesn't mean that I'm a pacifist. It doesn't mean that the use of force is never warranted. I just think that in the case of the initial intervention in Afghanistan, we had largely exhausted those other instruments, and therefore it did require the use of force to dislodge the al-Qaeda camps and to send a message to others around the world that actively harboring anti-American terrorist groups would end badly for them. And I think that mission was largely achieved by the early spring, frankly, of 2002. And then that begs the question, what have we been doing there since? And I don't think we have a lot to show for it in the subsequent involvement in Afghanistan.
To try and end on a positive note, let me ask you, do you think, when we think about foreign policy, perhaps from a generational perspective or a kind of demystifying of power, we had George W. Bush was very popular among Republicans and a lot of Democrats for his foreign policy. There was a lot of support. People like Hillary Clinton essentially signed on to Bush's foreign policy all the way through. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama had his fans. Donald Trump, in many ways, is blending the kind of worst attributes of both of their foreign policy. Is he forcing people, because now there are never Trump Republicans who were partly upset when he said, I'm going to bring people out home from Afghanistan or Syria. Is he forcing the type of reevaluation of kind of tribal loyalties and the status quo in a way that will shake up the military establishment to say, we need a whole different script here? And or is he doing that for younger people, where he's showing that, in fact, the use of military force, we might dress it up in these, these principles and these, flat waving the flag and everything, but really it comes down to kind of arbitrary whims by a commander in chief who may or may not really have the best interests of the nation at heart. Do you feel like he is demystifying power in a way that ultimately will have a salutary effect upon politics, especially foreign policy?
I do. I think that certainly among young people, there was a not so surprising skepticism of the use of force, because all they've known in their entire lifetimes, so millennials, generally speaking, they have known is U.S. involvement in Middle Eastern wars to uncertain, unpleasant ends so far. And so not so surprising, they were less supportive of the use of force and remain that way. I do think there's been some skepticism of the concentration of power into the office of the presidency, which I think Donald Trump has certainly accelerated that anxiety, which as you point out, sort of started following the Bush and Obama administration's extraordinary use of drone strikes and sort of extrajudicial killings and things like that. I think that's an element too. But above all, I think that there is a moment that is created by Donald Trump's emergence and victory in 2016 to revisit some of the tired assumptions of U.S. foreign policy. He demonstrated that someone who was willing to question the bipartisan consensus could win office. He hasn't demonstrated a reliable alternative to that consensus. And that reliable alternative is one that we really try to put forward and fuel to the fire, which is global engagement, peaceful global engagement, the United States continuing to trade with the rest of the world, to engage in diplomacy with the rest of the world, and to really use our cultural influence in a positive way and be less reliant on the use of force. I do think there is a broad bipartisan support for that approach to U.S. foreign policy. Trevor Thrall has written a lot about this, especially with respect to young people and the millennial generation. But I think it goes beyond just young people or people under the age of 40, for example. I think it also applies to people, I'm 52, another group of people who maybe came of adulthood at the end of the Cold War, but have seen the overextension of U.S. power since the end of the Cold War, and sort of questioning whether the benefits of our forward military presence and our active use of force over the years has actually benefited us strategically and economically. So I do believe there is, sort of like you say, and on a somewhat hopeful note, I do believe there is the potential for a bipartisan consensus around a new foreign policy, but it's not the one that President Trump has offered or one that he is likely to execute for as long as he remains in office.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We have been talking with Chris Preble. He is the Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Libertarian Cato Institute. He's the co-author, most recently, of Fuel to the Fire, How Trump Made America's Broken Foreign Policy Even Worse and How We Can Recover. And he's the solo author of the recent book, Peace, War, and Liberty, Understanding U.S. Foreign Policy. Chris, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you, Nick. Really appreciate it.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast and the other Reason podcasts by going to reason.com/podcasts or Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you again next week.